Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is Scott Pelley from CBS News, best known for his work on 60 Minutes, and who was anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News from 2011 to 2017. He's actually won more journalism awards than any other 60 Minutes correspondent, which in that group is saying a lot. And Scott Kelly has Pelley has a new book called Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. It contains stories of leaders from Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Trump to much less known people and organized around qualities. The chapter titles include devotion, gratitude, objectivity, hubris, and others. And it happens to come out just as CBS is rolling out its new morning team, headed by Gail King, and its evening news anchor, that seat is changing, Nora O'Donnell, now tapped for that. Scott, a pleasure to have you. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, it is such a pleasure to be here. I have wondered for 20 years what you look like, and now I know.
I'm sure it's a vast disappointment. Where did you grow up, and what made you want to be a journalist?
Well, I was born in San Antonio, Texas, but I grew up out in West Texas, which is a farming community, and I was there from about 3 years old all the way through college at Texas Tech University. I wanted to be a photographer. And so I got a job at the Lubbock Avalanche Journal newspaper as a copy boy. I had a little bit of a temporal problem. They only hired kids who were 16 and above, and I was 15. So my career in search of the truth began with a lie. I told them I was 16 and got the job as the copy boy. And I was doing that for about a year, hoping to get a job as a photographer at the paper, when the executive editor came in one day, a big barrel-chested guy with Marine Corps bearing, and he looked down at me as I was working on my high school homework, and he said, "Do you want to be a reporter?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I never gave it any thought." He said, "Well, do you or don't you?" And I said, "Well, sure, I guess." And I've been a reporter ever since. I was 16 years old.
How about that? And you were looking to get into photography, which is interesting. It's interesting in light of your subtitle, too, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. So as you got older than 16, how much did you come to see your career as a search for personal meaning through being a journalist?
You know, I think that came much later, Brian. In fact, maybe just in the last 15 years or so, you begin to eyewitness so many events. I was down at the World Trade Center when the buildings came down. I covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I covered the Clinton administration when President Clinton was impeached. I covered the campaign of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as well. And, you know, as you get older, you start to ask yourself the question of what does all of this mean? And it occurred to me when I was covering the ISIS attack on Paris a few years ago, in which 120 people were killed, I saw at a memorial, a makeshift memorial on a cobblestone street in Paris, children and women and men bringing these candles to this memorial. And I looked in their faces, this look of bewilderment, and I said to myself, I've seen these people before. I saw them at the World Trade Center. I saw them in Oklahoma City after the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building. And they were essentially asking, what's the meaning of life? And it occurred to me that that's the wrong question. We shouldn't ask the meaning of life. Life is asking, what's the meaning of you? And so I began to focus these chapters on the qualities that I found in people throughout my career.
Well, one of your chapters is called Objectivity, Learning from Unpleasant Truths. And I was interested to open that chapter when I looked at the table of contents, because objectivity is actually a controversial word in journalism these days, because so many people believe there can be no such thing as objectivity in any pure sense. Why did you take that as a chapter title?
Well, it was the best I could think of for this particular chapter, which centers on the U.S. bombing campaign in Afghanistan. I became concerned several years ago that a lot of civilians were getting killed in U.S. bomb runs. And so we went to a village in Kapisa province to try to piece together what happened to one family. Three generations of a single family were wiped out by a couple of American 2,000-pound bombs. And in looking at that story, I knew that it was a story that nobody in the United States was going to want to hear. But it was an important story to hear it because these civilian deaths were having a terrible effect on the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy to try to win the hearts and minds of the people, if you will. And so we discovered that indeed there was a Taliban rifleman in the house that was hit with the two 2,000-pound bombs. But then as we bored into it more, we spoke to the Air Force and others, and the question becomes, do you drop 4,000 pounds of TNT on somebody with a rifle? And nobody that we could find, even in the U.S. military, could justify this particular airstrike. It was a kind of story that no one wanted to hear, but a story that I thought Americans should hear.
You get to some tough stuff in that chapter that I didn't know about numerical formulas of how many civilian casualties are accepted when bombing to kill a suspected Taliban or Al-Qaeda high-value targets, quote-unquote. And there was an actual number. 30 civilian deaths were considered okay by the Pentagon for one leading Al-Qaeda or Taliban member. Did I read that right?
Well, not necessarily okay, Brian, but if they estimated that there were going to be more than 30 deaths, then they had to go to the president or to the Secretary of Defense for an okay. This was the bombing campaign that preceded the war in Iraq. The idea was they were going to kill Saddam Hussein and there wasn't going to be a war in Iraq. So they launched 50 bombing strikes on locations where they thought Saddam would be. And if they had expectations that they would kill fewer than 30 people, then they had the authority to go ahead and do that. They didn't have to ask higher command.
But not just for bin Laden, also other.
Saddam Hussein in this case.
Oh, Saddam Hussein. Oh, that was for Iraq. I see.
Exactly. So, but the head of high-value targeting at the Pentagon at that time told me that they did these 50 bombing runs and they didn't get anybody,
yeah,
but that they considered high-value targets, but they figure they killed about 200 civilians.
Not to linger on this too long, but do you happen to know if that's still U.S. policy with respect to any high-value target? When Trump came in, he talked about loosening the rules of engagement because the U.S. was being too cautious and not fighting to win as he campaigned on it.
Those were specifically the rules in 2003 around getting Saddam Hussein.
Right.
So what the rules are today about other scenarios, I don't know.
My guest is Scott Pelley from CBS News, 60 Minutes, and former CBS Evening News anchor. And we can take a few phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You write about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in 2016 in your chapter called Hubris. In the Trump part of that, one of the things you write about is some straight-faced lies he told you about the unemployment rate, and then his claim, I alone can fix it. Why of all the possible Trump things did you focus on those?
Well, they were the things that he told me in an interview, Brian. I was just amazed in the interview. For example, one of the things that you allude to, he told me in the interview that 93 million Americans can't get jobs. Well, if you do the math, that works out to an unemployment rate of 54%.
Right.
I mean, there are going to be people with pitchforks and torches at the
right.
White House.
There's only 300-something million in the country, and that includes children.
And the subset of actually working-aged people who are looking for a job is much, much smaller than the 300 million, of course, about half. So he would throw things like that out. He said 60%, in the same interview, 60% of American bridges are in danger of falling down, 60%. I called the American Society of Civil Engineers, and the number's not 60%, it's 6%. But what occurred to me, and this was during the campaign that we did that particular interview, it occurred to me that Trump was creating a dystopian America that didn't exist, but he had to have that in order to generate outrage and get people to the polls.
And on Hillary Clinton, you have this exchange where you asked her a question around the start of the Democratic convention in Miami in 2016 that you had asked her before if she had ever lied to the American people. people. Here's a very short excerpt of her response in that exchange.
I haven't always been perfect, but I don't know anyone who is. And we're going to have a campaign and a White House that the American people will be able to look at and believe that Tim and I are working every day for them, that they can count on us, that they can trust us.
Your critics are going to say, see, she didn't say, I will never tell a lie.
Well, you've done this to me before, Scott.
Meaning you had asked her that question before and put her in that position. But my question to you, Scott, is did you ask Trump the same point blank question about lying?
I did not have an opportunity to go back to Trump after that interview with Hillary Clinton. I certainly would have, and I certainly would today. I'd spend the entire interview on it. But here was my thinking there. And by the way, the Tim she's referring to is Tim Kaine, her running mate, who was sitting in the interview with us. The polling showed that Hillary Clinton was the most distrusted candidate ever to run for president. And it seemed to me that she urgently needed to do what Robert Kennedy used to call hanging a lantern on your problem. She needed to confront frontally, as often as possible, this concept of honesty and dishonesty, because the impression of the American people was very, very bad in that area. And so I wanted to give her those opportunities to hit back with the best answers that she could. A little bit later, we have this tradition at 60 Minutes in which our first broadcast of a election year, presidential election year, is the two candidates and extended interviews with both candidates. I was supposed to do the interview with Hillary Clinton. Her campaign called and said, look, we'll do the interview, but we won't do it with Scott Pelley. And of course, as you know, we can't let people tell us who and how and what questions we're going to ask in terms of interviews. So we didn't do the show for the first time because she wouldn't participate.
So she's the only presidential candidate nominee in the history of 60 Minutes, which started in like 1968.
The first one was Nixon and Humphrey. That was the first.
So she's the first one not to have done it.
As far as I know, Brian, certainly in the 20 years that I've been at 60 Minutes.
Because she didn't want to be asked by you about whether she ever lied to the American people.
That's right. And that was going to be an audience of something like 12 million people, and she ended up losing the election by 77,000 votes.
One other moment from that DNC interview. You asked Clinton to react to the brand new at that time DNC email leaks from the Russian hacking, specifically the one showing the DNC, which was supposed to remain neutral in the primaries, working against Senator Bernie Sanders and even considered using his reputed atheism against him. My question about that is, was there a policy discussion then at CBS News, because there certainly has been in the media in hindsight, about whether emails that came from Russian hacks were fair game for journalism?
Those emails had been released the day before. So we didn't know much about them. They'd come from WikiLeaks. No one knew that they had come from the Russian GRU at that point. And I had a conversation with my staff about that. And the point of that conversation was, are these real? How do we know these are real? They're on WikiLeaks. Are you kidding me? We're going to ask the nominee here or soon-to-be nominee about these things. How do we know they're real? The prevailing thought at the time was they're in the news. And if they're not real, we need to give her an opportunity to tell us that. And they were all over the news, which was right before the Democratic National Convention. And that is exactly what the GRU had in mind. It was impeccable timing on the Russians' part.
My guest is Scott Pelley from CBS News. His new memoir is called Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. By the way, he's going to be doing an event this evening at 7 o'clock at Book Culture, Columbus and 82nd Street in Manhattan. And Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Scott Pelley. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, and thanks very much. I'm wondering, as a member of the CBS staff, CBS was one of the many stations that took part in editorial reply opportunities before Reagan got rid of the fairness doctrine in the mid-80s and basically stopped requiring that stations provide that opportunity for responses to controversial statements or views. And it's now 30 years since then. It seems that that, with the internet, has contributed to the polarization of our electorate, people self-selecting media outlets on which they only hear views with which they agree. So two questions. Do you think that has had that kind of effect? Do you think most people know about that origin of the Fairness Doctrine abolition as leading up to this moment? And also, should stations voluntarily offer that kind of opportunity, even if the FCC doesn't require it?
Alan, that's three questions.
Okay.
You've been corrected by a journalist.
You have hit squarely on the head the single thing that concerns me the most about our beloved country. Never before has more information been available to more people, and that's a great thing, but also never before has more bad information been available to more people. You know, what's the greatest threat to our democracy? Is it terrorism? Is it war? Is it another Great Depression? I don't think so. I think the fastest way to destroy a democracy is to poison the information. And we have now moved from the information age to the disinformation age. And that's where journalism comes in, and shows like Brian's, for example, come in when we try to very soberly and carefully separate fact from fiction. Now, let me get to your question, if I may. Fairness doctrine change, I don't know if that was the big mover to where we are today. I think it has a lot more to do with cynical politics and the efforts of hostile foreign nations and the idiosyncrasies of the internet. Your second question is, do I think anyone knows about that? I doubt it. Very few people remember that fairness doctrine stuff. I miss it. I'm with you. But what we try to do at CBS and all of the responsible media is we try to present a balance of views, regardless of those views that we have on the broadcast. We try to balance them all out. So a very interesting question about the fairness doctrine. I'm glad you brought it up, because this is the one thing that worries me the most about the future of our country, is whether we can seize the initiative again in providing the American people with independent, balanced information.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. We have a few minutes left with Scott Pelley from CBS News, then the news, then Anita Hill. But a few things before you go, real quick. In the years that you anchored the CBS Evening News, and it kind of goes to the last caller's question, cable and the internet became increasingly important to how people get their news, for better or worse. It's such a far cry from the old days of the three networks dominating national news. How did you change it on your watch to make it relevant or have a unique place for today's news context?
You know, I thought of the evening news as perfect for today's news context, because we're now inundated, right? Flooded with all kinds of stuff everywhere all the time. But in the evening newscast on all three networks, what you have is a curated half hour of news. We're not going to waste your time. In 30 minutes, we're going to tell you the 10 or 12 most important things that happened today. And it's being done by serious journalists who are being supervised by serious editors in organizations like this one that would pay enormous consequences if they got something wrong, because we care about reputational damage at WNYC or CBS News or anywhere else. So I thought of it as a beacon of reliability and also a curated place where you can get the day's news in 30 minutes. What we did do was we started to stream it so that it didn't just come on at 6:30. And if you weren't home, sorry, you remember that, Brian. If you mm-hmm. wanted to see what was happening in the Vietnam War, you had to be sitting at home at 6:30. And right. if you missed that, then you had to wait another 24 hours. Well, now, of course, it's available everywhere all the time. And that was the big change. Not the content, but the distribution was a big change.
Stuart in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stuart.
Come on. Mr. Pelley, before I ask you the question, I just wanted to mention that you sound exactly the way you do on television. When you was 12 years old, people tell you you're a natural. Anyway, what I wanted to ask you, Mr. Pelley, was about the tobacco companies immortalized in the movie The Insider with Al Pacino. Did 60 Minutes learn any? What was the takeaway from all of that? And the lawsuit called tortious interference. I actually remember that. I just wanted to get your opinion of that. I know
one of the many very famous 60 Minutes stories. That wasn't yours, right?
No, that was Mike Wallace. And we did learn from that experience. To catch the audience up on what you're talking about, we put together a story with Jeffrey Wigand, who was a scientist for one of the tobacco companies. And Wigand said something that was revolutionary at the time, and that was that the tobacco companies calculated the amount of nicotine in cigarettes in order to keep people hooked. I know that's commonplace now, but at the time, that was a huge revelation. 60 Minutes kept that story off the air because of corporate interference, and the people at corporate headquarters were concerned because they were trying to sell CBS at that time to another company, and they didn't want any sort of any problems there. I think that 60 Minutes learned a lesson. More importantly, I think CBS Corporation learned a lesson that you want to err on the side of public service. Always, always, always. And I hope that that's what you find us doing today.
CBS, like many other places, was affected by the Me Too movement. From what I see, you didn't include that in the book. I don't see Charlie Rose or Les Moonves, for example, in the index. Did you go there at all?
I didn't go there at all in the book. The book was mostly written before those revelations. I did write about 2,000 words on the subject and then decided at the last minute to take it out of the book because we've moved so far since then. We have a new chairman of the CBS Corporation. We have a new president of CBS News and Susan Zirinsky. We had very difficult, dark management problems at CBS News over the last 6 years or so. A very difficult and harsh work environment for both women and men, which I complained about bitterly on the inside, which resulted in my being fired at the Evening News. But we have now recovered from all of that, and I didn't want to bring it all up again after we've made so much progress right now.
What led to you being fired from the Evening News?
I went to the bosses and said, you can't treat our employees this way. And they said, look, if you keep that up, we're going to let you go. I went to that person's boss and explained to him, and he said he didn't share my concerns. And then I went to the chairman of CBS News and explained to him what was going on, and he listened very intently. And then the next opportunity they had in my contract, they let me go.
But it didn't inform your reporter's search for meaning, quote unquote, enough to put it in the book.
Well, you know, that's about me. And I wanted to write a memoir, Brian, but I didn't want to write a memoir about me. I wanted to write a memoir about all the fascinating people I've met in my life.
And last thing then, the recent high profile changes at CBS News, flowing in part from Me Too, have Gayle King anchoring the morning show, Nora O'Donnell anchoring the evening news. What should the public make of those changes, in your opinion?
Well, I don't know if your memory goes back this far, but it's like the 1927 Yankees. This is murderer's row. They are going to be sensational. Gayle is one of the best interviewers in television ever. And Nora just has the intelligence. She has the curiosity. She has the leadership ability that's so important to move the evening news forward in this new information age. I could not be more excited. And you left one thing out, and that is that John Dickerson is going to be joining us as a correspondent at 60 Minutes. He has the interviewing skills of Mike Wallace and the writing skills of Bob Simon. He's going to fit right in.
Why does 60 Minutes have so much staying power when everything else goes away?
52 years. Next season is our 52nd year. It all goes back to what Don Hewitt told us to do. Tell me a story. You know, you'd go into Don's office and you'd say, Don, climate change. We got to do something on climate change. And he would wave you off and say, that's an issue. Tell me a story that illuminates the issues of climate change, but is a story that I can really settle into. And that's what we do.
Well, stories is what you will find in Scott Pelley's memoir called Truth Worth Telling. The word stories, excuse me, is in the subtitle, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. And as I said at the beginning, it's organized around chapter titles that are qualities like devotion, gratitude, objectivity, and others. And Scott Pelley will be doing a book reading and appearance at Book Culture at 82nd in Columbus tonight at 7 o'clock. Thank you so much for coming in.
Brian, great to see you. Thank you.